second case for oral argument this morning is Burt Hart v. Paul Hogg. The appellant's Brad Gordon, attorney from Spirit Vision. Mr. Gordon, you may proceed. First yourself, the appellant's counsel. Apologize for misintroducing. Also, I would note for the record that Justice Amundson has disqualified himself. Court is appointed to the Circuit Judge of the Seventh Circuit here in Rapid City to serve as a witness. May proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice Gilbertson, Justices Koenigkamp, Saber, Zinter, and support. Although the history of this case has been set forth rather extensively on brief, I think a few points to emphasis. First of all, the record, as we know, reflects this is a road easement case involving a parcel of land that rests on a hillside above Spearfish, South Dakota, Spearfish Canyon. That the land in question was purchased back in 1963 by late John I II, who is the late husband of Helen Iwalon. She's one of several appellants in this case. As we know, Mr. I property back in 1963 with the intention of subdividing it into nine separate lots, which he did in 1965 with the assistance of Bud Polly, a well-known land surveyor from the Black Hills, also an assistant. Mr. Polly prepared a plat in 1965, dividing the land in Spearfish Canyon into nine separate lots.
In doing that, did he stake it out?
Yes, sir.
And did he stake out the road?
Yes, he did.
I've not been into the record yet, but is on the plat then it shows exactly where the road is?
There is a line drawn on the plat map, Your Honor, that identifies the road. Record reflects through various photographs and testimony that the road was as depicted by the line drawn on the plat.
The road was cut in by the Caterpillar on scale with the road as drawn?
Correctly.
And it basically went into a V and then went back up the hill?
Yes.
Are there aerial photographs then that establish that that is also the case?
There are aerial photographs in the record, Your Honor, that depict that, that demonstrate that the road as actually cut by Mr. I's Caterpillar was as depicted on the plat, although there was no survey of the road itself.
After it was cut in?
Correct.
But it was staked, it was surveyed and staked, and then that's where the road was cut in?
The lots were surveyed, lot pins were. The road itself was staked, the road was not surveyed.
Well, how can you stake it without surveying? I mean, do you just put the stakes any place?
My review of the record reflects that Mr. Polly, Mr. I staked the road where they wanted it to be.
That's correct.
And they did so contemporaneously with the placement of the survey pins on the respective lots.
Did the road cross over anyone's lot other than Lilla Hogg?
Yes, sir. Several lots, including lower lots and the upper lots. And
later, when it was moved, did it move further on to other people's lots?
It moved more closely to the border of Lot 5, which was Kelly, Casey, and Otis Lilla Hogg.
But it didn't move on anybody else's property?
They did not move that portion that was altered off of the lot. That is my understanding.
Thank you. I understand your assertion concerning this easement, plat, suggesting plat easement.
Your Honor, all things considered, my review of the record, I think that's a fair characterization. That's not the only, but it is most definitely buttressed by the fact that the Kelly's Lily Hog put on notice when they purchased their lot that there was a road easement there as drawn on the plat map, even though there wasn't a survey. And I would say that the absence of a survey is a bit of a red flag because it doesn't really serve any identifiable purpose, given that the testimony establishes aerial photographs and other photographs establish that the road in question has stayed and constructed was as depicted on the plat. So yes, indeed, definitely an easement by implication that the Lily Hogs were on notice of time of purchase. Bear in mind, their deed specific acknowledges that their ownership rights are subject to easements expressed and implied.
Why do you concede that this is not a dedicated roadway for the private purposes of the people who buy the lots?
I do not concede that.
What would you have to do, say, right on the plat, dedicated to the owners of all the lots?
That was the ruling of the trial court, that it was not an express easement because there was no specific language.
But express words of dedication are used when you dedicate to the public, the city street, county street, township street, or something like this. Is it necessary to use the words of dedication when you're just putting a road easement or dedicating the road only to the people who own other lots?
Not in our opinion.
You could just say something like private road.
Exactly. Exactly. And again, the subsequent purchases, such as the road, that fact based upon not only what they can see, of course, the facts of implication, but what the plat map shows. I think you make a very good argument that this is not only the easement, but it is the easement.
What I don't understand then is why did you agree that it's appropriately characterized as an easement by implication?
It wasn't my intention to concede anything.
But you stated that.
I respect that, Your Honor. I would say that perhaps the strongest argument we made is the simple case. The easement was most definitely an easement. And it was there for 17 years before Mr. Lilyhoff decided to alter that portion that he didn't like, so that he could put his housework where he liked. In fact, he didn't even alter it for 5 years after. But with that said, I don't in any way shape or form concede that this isn't an express easement as well as an implied easement because of the argument you rather succinctly stated that this is in fact a private situation. Rules of dedication are generally, or rather words of dedication are generally reserved for roads and highways that are reserved for the public, not necessarily.
Disagree with the finding of the judge's precise location.
Yes, I do. Consider plat as well as the rest of the record, testimony, photographs, and evidence. There's also a concession by Kelly Casey Lilyhoff that, yes, indeed, the road is in fact where it's drawn.
So you could take a scale and you could determine the road on the aerial photograph and it would match up with the road as drawn on the plat.
It would, Your Honor. I believe the testimony reflects that. I don't believe there was much disagreement that in fact those aerial photographs demonstrate that the road as drawn on the plat was as shown. I think it's important also for the court to know a decision by Casey Billyhawk to alter that portion. Instructed and changed without the consent of the other owners, particularly the upper property owners. He simply decided to do it because it ran too close to his home, or rather to where he decided to build his home. And the other property owners, including the appellants, only learned of it after the fact.
It isn't entitled to make reasonable changes, as long as they don't unreasonably interfere.
Your Honor, as you can see from the appellant's brief, we disagree with the court's statement in that regard, because it's a partial statement of the restatement. The full restatement contemplates that that rule of law only applies if the facts of the placement of the road and circumstances surrounding the placement of the road weren't established in the first instance. That was, in fact, the case in this particular instance. The road, the circumstances surrounding the construction of that road were that the late John Ice built that road to provide access all of the lots, U.S. Highway 3, including the upper lots. And those upper lots, all of those lots, in fact, would have been landlocked had he not built that road. So I respectfully submit that the statement cited in support of the court's memorandum is only a partial statement of the rule of law from the restatement. The entire rule of law is set forth in our brief, and because it was a partial statement.
How was it? Do you say that someone, that he could not have changed the road at all?
The restatement contemplates that a servient, and a servient landowner, such as the Lilyhawks, would only have the right to make reasonable changes road without the consent of the other landowners. If the circumstances of the road hadn't established the purpose for the construction of the road in the first place, that's the complete statement. Judge Johnson's ruling was inaccurate because it was only a partial statement of the law. Full statement of the law is just as I have expressed. And so, once again, I disagree respectfully with the trial court's opinion in that. It suggests that the rule of law is that Appellee Lilyhawk had the right to make reasonable changes, whether he obtained the consent of the other property owners or not. And that is not the rule of law set forth in the restatement. And you will note from Appellant's brief a plethora of cases in various jurisdictions that establish that what I have expressed here is, in fact, the rule of law that prevails in this country. If the servient tenant wants to make changes, whether reasonable or otherwise, and I do not concede that this change was reasonable in any way, shape, or form, whether they want to make changes under the restatement, they have to obtain the consent of the other property owners. Now, with that said, was the change reasonable? Absolutely not. And I would ask the court.
You're saying it doesn't make any difference if they're reasonable or not.
That's correct.
So why are we discussing reasonability?
Just covering my bases. But I would like to address that just briefly.
Okay.
You'll see from the record that there is trial deposition testimony of civil engineer Neil Stadalski. Mr. Stadalski explains in his trial deposition that the road was an unreasonable alteration. It went from 12% grade to a 33% grade, which he characterized as exceedingly steep, not only because it is beyond county standards, which allow for a maximum of 12%, but also because of the tight curve involved. Mr. Stadalski explained that you've got a 33% grade, but with the alteration, you have an excessively tight curve, which makes the alteration all the more dangerous. So I won't say anything more about the unreasonable alteration, except that I urge you to pay particular attention, Your Honor, to Mr. Stadalski's deposition testimony, because it was never contravened by another expert. He's a civil engineer and a registered land surveyor, testified for the appellants.
But the trial court can determine, so you're arguing that that finding of fact by the trial court in relation to that is an error?
Yes.
You proposed findings on that point?
Yes.
So you're saying the trial court improperly dispensed with what the expert had to say about it?
Yes.
Even though it's the trial court's discretion to determine whether or not somebody's conclusions are based on the proper facts and so forth, even an expert's.
My position is that the trial court's ruling was erroneous in the face of this expert's uncontravened expert testimony with regard to the dangerousness of the alteration of the grade from 12% to 33%, and in view of the alteration which made an exceedingly tight curve out of that stretch of road.
Why should we talk to Judge Johnson's office? We always give deference to try to hear the witnesses testify on it, because the trial judge can see this is judgment. Here the judge actually drove this road and came back and said, changes are reasonable. Why shouldn't we give deference to Judge Johnson's actual view of it? We can't go to it. We have to accept his judgment.
I don't believe we do in the face of the expert trial deposition testimony, because of course the fact that it was a trial deposition allows.
Judge Johnson considered that evidence, the expert witnesses, and then he drove the road. He decided.
Two things. First of all, I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the law is settled that the South Dakota Supreme Court does not have to defer to the trial court with regard to trial deposition testimony, because you have the ability to read that and consider it as well as the trial court. Secondarily, it is correct that Judge Johnson drove that stretch of road, did so, however, in August. Drove that stretch of road without the benefit of examining it as it used to exist. And in that time of year, of course, it does nothing to establish for its direct observations what the upper lot owners have to deal with in the middle of the winter. We know how harsh winters can be.
You have 2 minutes, counsel.
I'd like to touch briefly, just very briefly, on the statute of limitations, because as we were 20 years for several reasons. First of all, by definition, real property, which we're trying to reclaim by trying to get back the easement, includes hereditaments, and case law establishes that an easement is an incorporeal hereditament. So by the definition set forth in the statute, the attempt to recover an easement is the attempt to recover the property. Hence the 20-year, not the 10-year statute. also, it's the ruling that the 20-year statute applies is consistent with prior rulings of the court regarding what it takes, how many years it takes to extinguish an easement. And that, of course, is 20 years as well. I would submit to the court that it would be inconsistent to say that you use 10 years for one and 20 for the other. Finally, as you may remember from previous case law, if there's any doubt, the court has said on a number of occasions, you use a longer statute of limitations. So for those reasons, I believe or heard as a matter of law when ruling 10 years apply, just as the court heard Latches apply in this case. I don't believe Latches applies in this case. First of all, any prejudice due to the delay in filing the suit was not because of any action or inaction on the part of the appellants. You must remember that the unilateral decision to alter this stretch of road was made by the appellees without the consent or approval or even knowledge of the appellants, as was the decision of the appellees to place their own homework. They have...
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon. Mr. Gruber, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Fred Gruber. I represent the appellees, AC and Holmes of Omaha. I noticed the court has some questions about the road, and I wanted to clear up a few things. If you review the testimony, both given at trial and during the deposition of the plaintiff's expert, Neil Stadalski, you will notice, and it's cited in my brief, that the aerial photographs that were presented at the time of trial demonstrate that the road as drawn on the plat are not the same. The plat contains no survey information to exactly locate the road. Page 20 of my brief, I cite to specific testimony that indicates that the aerial photographs demonstrate that the road as depicted on the plat is not the same as existed prior to the change in 1982. Not only for the portion that's in dispute, but also beyond that, the areas that have not ever been altered. Also, I'd invite the court to read the trial deposition and the live testimony of the expert, Neil Stadalski, who repeatedly testified that the plat does not accurately depict the location of the road prior to 1982. He testified that at best, he was to try to identify where the road was by using the plat alone. The only thing he could do would be to scale using measurements to try to guesstimate where that road was. And when he did that, he said that the best estimate that he could come up with where the center line of the road would be on the plat may vary by as much as 10 feet to either side of the center line. In fact, if you look through the exhibits that were admitted at trial, their experts' original estimation of the location of the original road showed the center line of that road passing through the Little Hogs home. Now, subsequent testimony showed that the road never did pass through the Hogs home, but that gives you an idea of how inaccurate that plat is. The court had some questions about staking of the road. I think if you review the testimony of John I III, son of John I II, he testified that when he was 9 years old, that's about third or fourth grade, he could recall being out working with his father. At the time, his father and the surveyor hiked through the hills and pounded stakes in where they wanted the road to be so that they could take the caterpillar and have some mark to work with while carving the road out of the side of the hill. There's nothing in the record that indicates that that road was surveyed. If it would have been surveyed, certainly the surveyor would have noted those survey pins or stakes on the plat. Would know exactly where that road was when it was originally constructed. I'd also like to point out that it was the trial court's job to weigh the testimony, consider whether the 9-year-old's recollection of the stakes means that the road as depicted on the plat is exactly where it used to be. The point point is, that plat, in my opinion, only shows the road to put purchasers on the right of access for all of those properties to use a road crossing. It's not a definite location. Also remind the court that the plat contains no language dedicating the roadway or granting it. South Dakota statutes obviously contemplate that when dedicating a roadway or granting it, in those plats, dedicate that roadway. In this case, all the appellants have the right to use a portion of Lot 5 to gain access to their property. They would like to use the plat to say that we are entitled to use this very piece of ground for access, yet the plat does not accurately depict the location. There's no language granting them the right to any specific parcel of property.
Excuse my ignorance, but how can the plat not depict the location of the road? Why not scale it off and come up with exact measurements of what the plat shows? I mean, the lines on the map don't change, so why not scale it off and set the pins and stakes the way the road shows it to be?
Well, Your Honor, if you were to do that, exactly scale it, set the road in the location of the plat, you would be creating a road that would never exist. In fact, if you review the testimony from Brad Ellis, the defendant's expert, he testified, and I believe Neil Stanowski agreed with this, that the road, if you use purely scaling, would be in locations that it's impossible to build the road due to the nature of the property itself. It's on a steep side hill. Scaling would place the road over an area that there is 15 feet because it's not on land. The road depicted in the plat did not ever exist in the location shown on the road. I will also comment on the appellant's claim that Casey Lillehog conceded that the plat showed the road. Casey Lillehog, on cross-examination, acknowledged that as a general rule, the road depicted in the plat follows the same path or pattern that the original road existed. He did not concede that the plat was an accurate depiction of the road that existed prior to the plat. I'd like to move on to address the statute of limitations briefly. As you know, Judge Johnson ruled that the plaintiff's claim was barred by the statute of limitations set forth in SEC subsection 4. That is a general catch-all statute of limitations. There is not a specific statute prescribing a period of limitations. In this case, the plaintiff's claim enforcement of an easement. And there is no specific statute that sets forth the statute of limitations. The trial court applied a 10-year statute of limitations. This road was changed in 1982. The suit wasn't filed until more than 17 years later. Consequently, the court barred the plaintiff's claim. The plaintiffs are asking this court to apply a 20-year statute of limitations set forth in 15-3-1. This statute does not apply. This 20-year statute of limitations is the statute which is the opposite of the adverse possession statute, set forth in 15-7. In order to acquire adverse possession, you must be in possession of the property for 20 years. 15-3-1 states that you cannot assert your claim to recover property, recover possession of property, unless you have been in possession of that property in the last 20 years. They're just exact opposites. In this case, this is not an action to recover real property or recover possession of real property. This is an action to enforce the easement. They have never been denied access across the land. Their quarrel is with the location of that access. Right? If it was an action to recover real property, certainly there would need to show some grant or dedication, giving them the right to parcel of property. In this case, the roadway has never been severed from title to Lot 5. They have a right to use Lot parcel of property. In addition to the fact that this was not an action to recover real property, recover possession of real property, as required by 15.1, also requires the claimant to be seized of or in possession of the property. In this case, neither none of the plaintiffs or their predecessors' interest have been seized of or possessed of the property. All they have right to use it. This court has recognized on at least two occasions that the easement is an incorporeal hereditary. Incorporeal hereditary is the right to use the parcel of property, not the right to possess or to seize.
Yes. Lines. Credibles. If it does,
respectfully disagree. It is a broad definition of real property. It defines it to include basically anything associated with real property. Hereditaments are divided into corporal hereditaments and incorporeal hereditaments. In this case, we're dealing with incorporeal hereditaments, not a corporal hereditament. I would submit to the court that the definition of real property only deals with the right to possess and seize property. In this case, the court has ruled on at least two prior cases that the easement is not a right to possess the property. The same argument raised by the appellants in this case was rejected by the Florida court in the Kitzinger versus Gulf Power case. In that case, the Florida courts applied, or they did not apply, they refused to apply, a statute of limitations that is substantially the same in South Dakota. The difference Florida statute, and South Dakota's, is that Florida's had a 7-year statute, South Dakota's. I believe I have attached the Kitzinger case and the Florida statute to the briefs. I'd like to review them. I should also point out that the trial judge ruled in favor of my clients in two different cases. First was the statute. Secondly, the court found that there was not an unreasonable alteration of the roadway. Finally, the court determined that the plaintiffs were being barred by the doctrine of latches. I want to touch on a few things. The court's finding that this was not an unreasonable alteration.
Let me start into that.
Yes.
How do you respond to Mr. Gordon's observation that section of the lease statement on this issue appears to suggest that section of the lease statement in this case?
I disagree. The restatement section actually squarely applies to this situation. If you look at the introductory language, section 4.8, it says that it shall apply except where the location of the dimensions are determined by the instrument or circumstances surrounding the creation of the servitude. In this case, there is no instrument creating the servitude. And in fact, this roadway, the testimony shows, was rarely ever used until after the Lillihogs began developing their property on 1977. I believe the plaintiff, William Burkhart, testified that after purchasing this property, as he used the road to access his property, the first time he went up there, the road was so out of use that there were trees and all growing road beyond the Little Hawk property. I would submit to the court that after the road was used for the past 20 years in its current location, it has now been established through the use and acquiescence of the parties. The trial court found that the appellants had acquiesced in its use for waiting 17 years. The court may also recall that plaintiff Burkhart purchased his property, owned it for 2 years, then built a home on it in 1995, lived in that home for approximately 3 years, then finally brought suit against the Lillihogs, seeking a mandatory minimum voted for its original application. I'm also seeking to recover the road building property. In determining whether this was an unreasonable alteration of the road, the trial court had to compare the road as it existed prior to 1980, the road that now exists. After considering all of the testimony, all of the evidence, including the plaintiff's own expert's testimony regarding the inaccuracy of the plat, the court found that the road prior to 1980 was used by the occasional summertime access. Very rarely used. There's no evidence in the record that it ever provided access. The court and testimony described the road as a mere cat trail apart from the side of the hill. I think the appellant's witness described it as a two-wheel track with grass growing in the middle. The road was never maintained. The turn on lot 5, which is the subject of this dispute, was described by the plaintiff's own expert as a switchback. And if you're familiar with mountainous roads, they switch back and forth to gain elevation. After the change, the curve is a sweeping turn that can be negotiated in one fluid movement, continuous movement. The plaintiff's expert acknowledged that the road, old road, at such a sharp degree of turn, the person driving the road would need to come to nearly a complete stop or a complete stop in order to negotiate the sharp turn of the road. The current road, on the other hand, provides access on a year-round basis, four-wheel drive in the winter, two-wheel drive in the summer. In fact, the day before trial, plaintiff Burkhardt drove the road in a two-wheel drive Buick or Mercury. There's also a videotape in there that shows the cement truck deliver cement lots 8 and 9 just a few days before trial.
How far is the front of the house, your client's house, from the edge of the road now?
Right now, I'd estimate it's between 50 and 60 feet.
And how close was it? How close was it when the road was there?
By all accounts, within a few feet of the of my client's garage and within a few feet of their house.
So it came right up to where he built the front of his house?
Yes. Yes.
A few feet, you mean something less than 5?
Definitely less than 5 for the garage building. And I'd say between 3 and 10 of the house.
Did he ever seek legal advice or attempt to obtain the consent of the other people who own the lots before he changed the road?
No, the only testimony necessary was that he contacted the county when he was getting ready to move the road, and they said that that's beyond our jurisdiction. There's also testimony in the record that indicates that the road were restored to this very vague location that existed prior to extremely dangerous. Coming down a steep hill towards the garage within 2 or 3 feet of where the garage building located since 1977, and taking a very abrupt turn to continue down the hill on a switchback turn, and coming within 5 to 10 feet of the Villahawks home. Obviously, that would be very dangerous. It would also increase noise, dust, a number of the improvements that the Villahawks have made to their home. Villahawks purchased this property in 77, put the garage building in. In 82, when the road was changed, the only thing the Villahawks had done to the lot was to dig out an area to build their home and pour a basement. That was the time when they changed the road. Over the next 7 years, Casey Villahawk and his wife Lotus physically worked themselves by cutting the trees, built their home with their own hands. Over that 7 years, no action was taken by any of them.
You have 2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you. No demands were made for the road to be changed to its original location. In 89, my clients moved into their home on lot 5, lived there ever since. For the past 13 years they've lived in that home. Since that time, they've retired after 41 years working at the state land. And I trial my client is 74 years old. Their station in life has changed substantially. The plaintiffs now claim that they should be able to come to the court and ask for the court to order the road to be put back into the location. We aren't certain of it has not existed for more than 2 years. It's inequitable. They had plenty of time to take action. Therefore, I think the trial court's ruling on the latches issue should also be. In conclusion, Your Honors, I would ask for the court to confirm the trial court on all these types of findings barred by the statute. That the change to the road made by the Lillehog was not unreasonable, it was a question of fact. Thirdly, the plaintiff's claim is barred by the doctrine of latches.
One question.
Certainly.
When your clients moved the road, did they move the road onto more of either of the properties on either side of them?
No, Your Honor. Total movement turn for purpose, which meant turn, was fully contained in their property. If there was any change that affected any other property physically, possibly the approach to the curve may have changed a bit, and that was on Lot 6, which was also owned by the Lillehog. It was owned by Casey Lillehog and the Secretary Lillehog. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gould. Mr. Gordon, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Getting back to the issue of latches, I think it is important to acknowledge that Casey and Lotus Lillehog are the ones who decided to place their home where they did on Lot 5. To suggest that they were prejudiced by the appellants because of this perceived delay does not acknowledge the fact that they alone decided where to put their house. Knowing at the time where the portion of the road easement was in relation to where they put that house, they made the conscious decision to place the house and build the house and garage where they did. And I submit, contemporaneously, they decided to move the road without any consent or knowledge of any of the other parties.
They do have something of an argument, though, because if your people had come in and objected after they moved the garage to where they did, which is going to be 3 foot within the road or by the road, if you'd have come in and objected at that point, then they may not have had their house. Was their house all done by the time they did the road?
I believe that's correct, Your
okay.
Honor.
Well, maybe they don't have such a garage.
Right, and not only that, of course, the appellants aren't concerned about where they put their garage. We're concerned about where they put the road. And the extreme alteration of the grade and the tightness of the turn that resulted when they did move the road from its original configuration. It's a 12% grade, remember, with the switch path. Went from 12% to 33%, which Mr. Sadolsky said was way beyond county standards and exceedingly steep. Now,
didn't your client
according to the judge's findings, all the vehicles, all the construction, reach lots.
Your Honor, I, with all due respect to the trial court, I think that's pure speculation. Of course, we don't know because the cement trucks didn't have the benefit of the switchback road as originally configured. With that said, you will remember from the transcript of Mr. Burkhardt's testimony that in the winter months, he had to park his vehicle below the backpack up to his home because of the reconfigured portion of the road as it traversed Lot 5. I believe he had a four-wheel drive vehicle. Ultimately, he said he had to back that up to his home. That's how he got it. With regard to latches, Your Honor, I would ask the court to pay particular attention to his decision, Falls versus Miller, and the language there that distinguished some cases cited by the city, stating that those cases showed great prejudice with regard to the issue of latches, unlike apparently the facts in Sioux Falls. And that's consistent with a number of courts who have said that if you're within the statute of limitations period, simple latches, simple prejudice, we don't concede that there's any prejudice of the hands of the appellants at all. But simple prejudice alone is enough. If you're within the statutory period for limitations, you need to show great prejudice, extraordinary circumstances, compelling circumstances in order to prevail on a latches argument. Most certainly, that hasn't been demonstrated. Any prejudice is ultimately the result of what the appellees did of their own hand in the first instance. Once again, appellees would argue that there was a long delay in filing suit, but you will see from the record they tried to work it out, and there were extensive conversations throughout the years from the Galeys, from Dr. Ospas, John I, with regard to the problems they were having with that road. No avail. Ultimately, they filed civil suit. Well, remember this as well. That road, as originally configured by the late John I II, was there for 17 years before it was altered by Mr. Lillehammer. I think that's a point that shouldn't go without consideration. However, Dr. Ospas testified that while he didn't use it in the wintertime, he, prior to the alteration of the road, had intended to build up there. So I submit that is something that you should consider as well, Your Honor. With regard to the restatement, the dispositive language we submit requires the court's consideration of the circumstances surrounding the creation of the circumstances. Those circumstances, John I II, platted that parcel of land. He staked and bulldozed that road from 385 lots involved to provide reasonable access from 385 to each and every one of those lots. Those are the circumstances surrounding the creation of that service. Those circumstances are why the appellees did not, under the law, correct reading of that restatement, have the unilateral right without the consent of the adjoining property owners to change that road. And again, that is consistent with the bulk of the case law. With regard to the statute of limitations, Judge Tice, you are correct. SDCL 2-14-2, subsection 20, has no distinction between corporal and incorporal hereditary. Incorporal hereditary is real property by definition, and it needs to be incorporal hereditary. So I submit to you that statutory law alone establishes the 20-year statute. That, once again, all those other arguments, back to that, it would be illogical and inconsistent to say that a 10-year statute is what you have for enforcing it.
Thank you, counsel. I'd also like to welcome the students of Red Cloud High School who attended this oral argument. And if any of you did not hear it in the previous session, the 11 o'clock case of People Fund versus Score versus Wegeman will have to be continued till a November term because of the death in the family of one of the attorneys. Obviously, all of you may not be able to attend that hearing, but this gentleman who's been sitting over here in the corner for 3 days is conducting an experiment which will allow us, commencing in November, to carry our oral arguments live over the internet. And our website is available at the back cover of the case summary booklet, which all of you can pick up. So if you wish to hear that argument in November, you can simply dial it up on the internet website. Also, if you have any interest in how any of these cases ultimately are decided by this court, once the decisions are issued by this court, within a day or two, they are also posted on that website and you can look them up and read them. This then would conclude the term for October held here, and we go on the road. It is no quick and easy task. It takes nearly a year of planning and a lot of hard work by a lot of people to make this go as smoothly as this is going. I'd like to specifically thank President Richard Day Gowen of this institution and his fine staff for the many, many hours they have put in to make sure that this went very well. We'd like to thank the South Dakota Highway Patrol and the Rapid City Police Department for providing security, Pennington County Bar for its assistance, and also our staff, which put in a lot of time. This is also a milestone for this court. With the end of this term, Justice Amundson will conclude his service on the court and retire. Obviously, this is bittersweet for us because we have no one to expect to stand both intellectually and as a friend. He's a very dedicated public servant. Unfortunately, disqualifying himself on this last case we didn't sit on, but we wish him well, and he has agreed to assist us in the interim and the additional caseload until his successor is named by the governor. So with that, we are in